This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of October, and this week the fight with China really started to hit home. Or rather, it changed in several directions at once. On one hand, President Trump has been at pains to tell everyone who will listen how well trade talks are going with China in the run-up to his meeting on Friday with the Chinese vice premier. And the stock market has been rising, as it does when it thinks trade war de-escalation is likely and things are looking rosier with China. But at the same time, the NBA is embroiled in its own China controversy. After Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted his support for protesters in Hong Kong, the Chinese have punished the NBA and the Rockets, taking them off television in China and pushing for an apology. Later in the show, we'll look at that and also at President Trump's surprise decision to withdraw support for Kurdish forces who control much of northern Syria and are holding captive thousands of ISIS rebels. Stephen Cook of the Council on Foreign Relations will join us to talk about what our withdrawal of support means for the region, for our security, and the fate of all of those ISIS prisoners. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. And on the left is Lynette Lopez of Business Insider. Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Josh.
I want to start this week with the Democratic presidential primary, because I think as all the impeachment news has swirled, there have been some events that have really significantly changed the shape of that race. We've seen Elizabeth Warren continuing her steady climb in the polls. Joe Biden's actually been pretty steady. He's maybe down a point in the polling averages. So when he's lost his lead in some polls, it's mostly about Warren's continued rise. And of course, Bernie Sanders has faced an interruption in his campaign because he had a heart attack. Lynette, I look at this, and you have these three leading options among Democrats. It really feels to me like we haven't seen this to completely happen in the polls yet, but it feels like there have been significant detriments to the Sanders campaign and to the Biden campaign, and it looks better than ever for Elizabeth Warren.
It does look better than ever for Elizabeth Warren, but I wouldn't count Joe Biden out per se. Warren seems to be taking points from every single candidate. She's taking a little bit from Kamala. She's taking a little bit from Buttigieg. You know, she's kind of evenly stealing. So that does not count Joe Biden out. What I will say is a little difficult for the Biden campaign is that I think that this Ukraine matter is really bringing anti-corruption to the forefront of the campaign. And that is something that Elizabeth Warren has been championing from the beginning. She has, you know, a ban on former politicians going into lobbying, and she has already presented a bunch of options for how to combat corruption. And now I think Americans are becoming very alive to the idea that it is a real problem here, and that it has been a real problem at the very tip top of our political structure.
Rich, I think the other argument in favor of Biden's chances right now is I think a lot of people looked at this Ukraine story developing, looked at a response that, at least in my opinion, was pretty weak. It's been remarkable to me how little energy Biden has put into defending himself. He's been doing a lot of whining that, you know, the people around him saying the DNC should do more, sending a letter to the New York Times complaining about their coverage, not really seizing the opportunity to have the one-on-one fight with Donald Trump, where Donald Trump is making some fundamentally unfair attacks about him. You would think it would be an opportunity to showcase himself. He hasn't seized on that. And yet you do see in the polls him basically holding his ground, which suggests to me that at least so far, Democratic voters are not looking at this and saying either, gee, you know, even though this isn't a crime, I'm bothered by what Hunter Biden was doing in Ukraine, or saying, gee, I'm really worried that Donald Trump is going to beat the crap out of Joe Biden with this in a general election. Better find someone else. He still is tied for the lead in the polls.
He sagged, ticked down a little bit in the averages, but there's some polls, there's a Fox poll just out that has him about 32 and 10 points ahead of Warren, where he's been for a long time. But there are a lot of other polls now that show Warren a little bit ahead. And as Lynette points out, it's basically because she's consolidating the non-Biden vote bit by bit and stealing votes from the rest of the candidates. So I think she's a formidable candidate. I don't count Biden out yet. I think we're getting a truer picture of his strength. He wasn't a traditional front runner that was just going to stomp the field. The fundraising numbers are not good for him. You know, he's with third or fourth in the field or something like that, which is not associated with a traditional front runner. And his reaction to Trump, I think, one, it goes to Biden's not a great performer now. And I think there'd be naturally kind of a righteous response, you know, leave my family out of it. But at the end of the day, the problem he has is there's just no defense of the propriety of what Hunter Biden did. And that's the big threat to him going forward.
I think the needle he's failed to thread here, though, is I agree with you, there's no great defense of what Hunter Biden did, but I think there is a good defense of the propriety of what Joe Biden did. There have been a lot of claims from people associated with Donald Trump that Biden acted improperly by pressuring the Ukrainians to fire this chief prosecutor as he did toward the end of his term as vice president. And I think Biden has a strong argument to make that, A, that guy was corrupt. He was not actually aggressively pursuing corruption. Our move was an anti-corruption move, not a move to protect my son or anybody else. And B, it had bipartisan support. And you had letters from Republican senators like Ron Johnson supporting the move that Biden took at the time. So I think that is the argument that he really could be out there forcefully making, but I don't really see him making it.
I think that there is a lot to be unpacked about this story and simplified for the American people about what is corruption in Ukraine and what is not corruption in Ukraine. Most Americans are not familiar with the history of Yulia Tymoshenko and Viktor Yanukovych and everything that happened during the Orange Revolution. And getting everyone up to speed in this really crazy story that involves, you know, two thuggish-looking men who have been associated with Rudy Giuliani and Don Jr. and kind of trying to understand the difference between Ukraine after the revolution and then once the Russians invaded. It's just complicated. And even for a skilled politician like Joe Biden, breaking down that story is hard. Getting around that story is really difficult. And I don't envy the position that he's in, because having to explain Ukrainian politics is a mind meld.
Well, so, Rich, what do you make of the story of this arrest of these two Ukrainian-American businessmen, associates of Rudy Giuliani, who had become very quickly influential Republican donors, backing a pro-Trump super PAC, involving themselves in a number of races? This indictment, which indicted them for a number of things, one of which is concealing their donations through a company, concealing the fact that they came from them personally, also routing donations through each other and therefore giving donations in excess of legal contribution limits. So, but we learned other things in this indictment. One, for example, was there had been this sort of odd push by Congressman Pete Sessions, who was a long-serving Republican from the Dallas area, was defeated for re-election in 2018. He was one of the early people pushing for the termination of this of the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, who Giuliani and his associates had identified as hostile to their efforts to gin up investigations of the Bidens. Why was Pete Sessions involving himself in this dispute? And then you see that, you know, right around the time that he made this statement seeking the removal of the ambassador, he received a donation from these shady businessmen. And so I realize, you know, the president isn't responsible for the action of every person who supports him necessarily, but it seems like they, you know, by getting in with Rudy Giuliani, these people are awfully close to his inner circle. There's, you know, the one of them has a photo with the president. They were having dinner with Don Jr. It feels like now that these people are under indictment, a supporter of the president's ought to worry about what we're going to learn from these people.
Yeah. So the indictment itself doesn't directly have anything to do with Ukraine, but it goes to the fact these are sleazy and disreputable operators that Rudy Giuliani was quite close with. And this is the, you know, the big shoe that's yet to drop, is what exactly Rudy was doing there in Ukraine on behalf of Trump, on behalf of himself and his own business interests. And I think this, it does open up a slightly new vista on the worst case scenario, which I would say the worst case scenario, like last week, was there a real quid pro quo, you know, put directly to the Ukrainians. Now it's like, well, was there also corrupt dealings by Rudy Giuliani that maybe Trump was aware of? I think so. The Overton window stretched a little bit this week on the worst case.
Trying to just stop this at Rudy Giuliani is a little naive, okay? Paul Manafort was involved with Ukraine for a decade. He is the one who commissioned a law firm to write this pithy reasoning for why Yulia Tymoshenko was put into jail by Viktor Yanukovych, who was one of the Putin puppets who then controlled Ukraine. I mean, these are bad, sleazy, horrible people. And both of these men who are connected to Rudy are connected to all of that. So to say that this stops with Rudy or, you know, somehow appeared at the in the middle of the Trump campaign or just started with this Biden situation seems a little naive given the connection that the early Trump campaign has to Ukraine, dealings with Ukraine and to Ukrainian oligarchs. I mean, one of these guys owns a nightclub called, what is it, Mafia Hang?
Mafia Shore, Mafia Coast.
Mafia Coast. Like,
yeah.
I can,
and their company was called Fraud Guarantee.
Help me, God, to understand. How, like, what is going on here?
Well, and also, this is just one of the stories we learned this week about Rudy's shady financial connections to international criminals and how that has flowed through into policy conversations in the White House, which is we also learned about Reza Zarrab, Iranian Turkish metals trader who was under indictment in the United States, and he had some negative information about people close to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, and so the Turks wanted this guy released from prosecution, allowed to leave the United States, and basically you had Rudy Giuliani in the Oval Office with Michael Mukasey, the former Attorney General, both of them representing Reza Zarrab, pushing Donald Trump to cancel the prosecution of Reza Zarrab, find something we could trade with the Turks to let him go. And then the president says to then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, hey, you know, find a way, work this out. And I realize that didn't come to fruition. But Rich, I think part of what we're seeing here that's a theme among all of these stories is how important it is that John Kelly is gone. Which is to say, there have been a lot of people in the president's orbit maybe trying to take advantage of him. Maybe he understands fully what they're up to. I don't know. I'm not sure how much that really matters. But you have had people who were in the administration trying to push back against these instincts. People like Tillerson, people like John Kelly. And now they're gone, and the president effectively does not have a chief of staff. And I think that may help us understand what happened in July with regard to Ukraine, is you had all of these corrupt people around the president for a long time. What's missing now are the people who tried to contain his worst instincts.
Yeah, he needs someone at his elbow constantly saying, no, sir, don't do that. They'll impeach you if you do that. Or that's crazy. You'll get killed in the press if you do that. No, no, no. Don't do that. And he's had some people like that, but he comes to hate them and disdain them and to belittle them and to fire them. And that's basically what happened to John Kelly. And Rudy is just an example of a White House process that was out of control. And it wouldn't have happened. Again, I've said this before. It wouldn't have happened if Mike Pompeo or John Bolton were in control of Ukraine policy, but they weren't. Like, John Bolton was deliberately cut out of this. And again, we don't know how bad it is exactly what Giuliani was doing, but it certainly wasn't good. And at the very least, in a process
Would have stopped this?
I don't trust Pompeo at all, but he's been lying about knowing about this situation from the beginning. He said he wasn't on the Ukraine call and wasn't aware of it, and he actually was.
He never quite said he wasn't on the call. He strongly implied that he hadn't been on the call, but he also clearly didn't do anything
about
it.
It was just short of a lie.
It was in response to the whistleblower complaint, which he hadn't seen. But look, I think people were freaked out about that call, and people tried to stop the call from happening because they were afraid something inappropriate would be said, and it was. And Trump kind of worked around them with the help of Rudy Giuliani. Now, ultimately, you know, he's the president of the United States. It's all on him.
I'd like to take a second and apologize for the city of New York, from the city of New York, for what's about to transpire, because if Giuliani and Trump start going at each other, this is going to be so senile and so ugly.
Well, but so it actually brings me back to a tweet that President Trump sent years ago about Obama saying, can you impeach a president for gross incompetence? And I mean this sort of jokingly, but if we're having these conversations about corrupt things happening in and around the Trump administration, what we're trying to figure out is does Trump understand them or not? It just feels like that shouldn't be the important question. I mean, if you're allowing people like Rudy Giuliani to use the foreign policy of the United States to their own financial ends, and Giuliani, by the way, was supposed to be in Vienna. These two business people who got arrested were at Dulles Airport trying to leave the country with one-way tickets to go to Vienna, and then Rudy Giuliani was supposed to be there the next day, although he was trying to claim that he wasn't there to meet with them. He just happened to also be going to Vienna. Whatever Giuliani is doing, it is an inappropriate use of U.S. government resources, and the president is allowing it to happen, which seems important.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to the founders considered making maladministration an impeachable offense, and Madison said, "No, we're going to take that out because it's so vague. It means, you know, president's basically serving at the on the discretion of Congress. It's too vague." But that's a lot of what we're talking about is maladministration. Whether it's something worse is what we're trying to get the bottom of.
What I'm wondering is, why is the president letting Rudy Giuliani do this? Okay, I get the Ukraine thing. That's Joe Biden. He's attacking a political opponent. Why is Giuliani able to whisper in the president's ear so much? Why is his corrupting influence so powerful when the president could get in trouble for XYZ? What does the president
about? He likes Rudy. You know, Rudy is his kind of guy,
okay.
One. And two, on Ukraine, Rudy was telling him, sir, we're going to get to the bottom of how the Russia story began and of, I'm sure, we'll learn more about this, some vast corruption conspiracy involving the Bidens. So Trump's like, okay, I'm all in. You know, go get him, Tiger.
I guess my point is I'm just not sure it's that important to get inside the president's head. That he is allowing Rudy to do this, I think, is an impeachable offense. I don't think we ever necessarily need to fully understand his psychology, nor can we necessarily. I'd want to get back quickly to the 2020 Democratic campaign because there were a couple of points on this that I wanted to hit. One is I feel like it's weird how little discussion there's been of the fact that Bernie Sanders had a heart attack.
I think it's weird, too.
I mean, doesn't it, you know, I mean, I guess it partly reflects that the media has never taken Sanders quite as seriously as even when his polling suggested the media really should have been taking him seriously. And so now that he's underperforming a bit what people expected, the media takes him even less seriously. But like, is a party really going to think about making a 78-year-old man who just had a heart attack its nominee?
No. I mean, there's going to be a lot of fond feelings towards him. And in the debate next week, he'll get enormous applause. And everyone, you know, likes the fact that he's back on his feet and wants him to be, you know, healthy again. But the idea of nominating him in a high-stress presidential race when you just don't know what might happen again, I think it really it's really going to limit his appeal.
It fends off the eventual Warren Sanders civil war that everybody was thinking was about to happen. And, you know, I wish Bernie Sanders well, but this makes the decision a lot easier for people within the party because Warren is spry. Okay.
And then the other thing that's happened is that this controversy over Elizabeth Warren very early in her career as a teacher and why she did not come back to work again in the New Jersey school district that she had initially been a teacher in, and this story that she has told about that, you know, she became pregnant and they told her about the job she was supposed to have. You know what? Actually, we're going to hire somebody else for that. When she talked previously to her political campaigns about this experience, she had not explicitly mentioned that she had been fired for this. And so some people have jumped on that and said, you know, this is a story that she made up. I look at this, I really struggle with the idea that this story is anything, which is to say, you know, the fact that you talked about losing a job in two different ways at two different times and did not mention that you were fired once, I don't think is strong or conclusive evidence that you are making up the fact that you were fired. I don't think Warren has conclusive proof here that what she described happened, but I think it's plausible, and I don't think the fact that she once talked about this without explicitly saying that makes it implausible. I'm surprised by the legs that this controversy has had.
I agree. And there's a lot of shame for women surrounding this topic specifically about the fact that it happens and the fact that you might blame that for you being fired. A lot of people in our society say, you know, it wasn't your pregnancy. It was something about your performance. They're in denial about the reality of this issue. And it's hard for women to talk about it openly.
Is there something here?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can't know definitively, but the records which indicate that she wasn't fired because she's pregnant, they might, you know, they might have just been glossing that over and not giving the true reason, but accords with her prior version of the story, which was completely innocent in 2007. It's not that she left it out. She offered more details about what happened that suggested this wasn't the reason. So I think this is a case where she's getting special treatment from the media, and the media says because it happened to other women, it must have happened to her. But that obviously is a logical fallacy.
I think both versions of this story could be true at the same time. I mean, for one thing, there's this record of the decision by the board to rehire her for another year. That's from April. Warren says she became visibly pregnant in June, and then they came to her and said, actually, we're going to give that to somebody else. And I don't think that you would have written in the files, you know, actually, we're firing her because she is pregnant. And it might have been a more informal conversation that would not have been noted in the files at all. So I don't, you know, and I think that when people go through an experience like that, they don't necessarily feel like describing it in detail. And I think that it is plausible that she was fired for this reason, that it also that she had her own, you know, internal conflicts about whether she wished to work while she had a young child. She talked about that she, you know, that she taught for a while and then she had a young kid, and that was part of why she stayed out of the workforce. So I just don't think the two versions of the story are inconsistent, and absent additional evidence, I don't see a reason to. I think partly people are jumping on this because of the Native American story. I think that there is one story out there about Elizabeth Warren misrepresenting an aspect of herself in a way that was relevant for her professional career. And so I think there's an idea of, oh, you know, is there a narrative here? Is there other stuff like that? Obviously, she wouldn't be the first politician ever to have a plausible story about herself that relates to the public that she starts telling about herself, if if that were the case. But I just don't see a reason to infer that based on the information that we have.
Well, I think the falsehood about her Native American background is a contributing factor. But when you know you become a front-running politician, there's a lot of attention to details about your stories, especially ones that are really dramatic. And there should be, because very often politicians make these things up. They might not even be doing it deliberately. It's telling a story over time, and it steadily gets better to be an audience pleaser.
I think what the media is accepting is that there is a lot of shame around stories like this, not that she said it happened, so it happened, or it could happen, so it must have happened.
But she said in 2011 that she couldn't get a job after law school because she was pregnant. She could have said that then. About the teaching job,
she doesn't have to say the same thing the same time every time she says something. She doesn't have to say it the same way.
This would be circumstantial evidence that the story is a dramatic part of her bio that's really convenient when she's a political candidate, and that she never mentioned it before, even though she talked about obstacles to her career when she was pregnant.
Well, but that's also consistent with that these people have embarrassment about these sorts of things. To the extent even they don't want to trouble other people with their problems. It feels, you know, it can feel self-centered to talk about, you know, well, I was fired 40 years ago for this sort of thing. So
but
when you're not
telling, she was telling a self-centered story about not having career opportunities after she graduated from law school because she was pregnant. So why wouldn't she have mentioned the teaching?
I think it is not implausible that people would emphasize different things in their stories when they are candidates for political office than when they are not. It becomes a story that is relevant for the broader public and about what you would do in policy to change things that you might not feel as inclined to tell publicly if you were not seeking office.
It is a very embarrassing thing for women to discuss.
Discuss one aspect of what was embarrassing, but not bring this up?
This is a far more detailed story about an
experience.
You guys
are bending over backwards to give her credibility on this.
I don't think I'm bending over. I mean, I think it is true that the media feels favorably to her compared to other candidates. And I think you're right that there are, you know, when you have stories like this where you can't know the facts and you have to decide, you know, who you're going to believe based on incomplete evidence, I think always that enters into it. And I think people in the media do have relatively favorable views toward Elizabeth Warren. But I don't think that means that there is a fact that you can divine out of this. I think that will happen with the electorate, too. I think that when you have a story like this where people can look at it and believe whatever it is that they wish that they believe, they can, because there is no, you know, conclusive fact of the matter about what happened with her employment in the early 70s.
And couldn't get a job is a very general statement. To say that I worked at this school with these people and they did this thing to me because I was pregnant is a far more painful story to tell and a far more it's more weighted and it's more embarrassing and it's more it's just more personal, and it's, you know, I can understand wanting to avoid it.
We have to leave that there. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider to talk about the NBA and China. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Lynette Lopez, columnist of Business Insider. So let's talk about China. Last Friday, Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted, quote, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong," unquote. That might sound anodyne enough in the American political context, but it drew outrage in China, where the NBA and especially the Rockets are wildly popular. The Chinese reacted to punish the NBA, pulling Rockets merchandise off the markets and taking NBA preseason games off the air. China wants an apology, and they want it in the form they usually seek it from multinationals that go against the Chinese line by, for example, presenting Taiwan as a separate country from China. Marriott International respects and supports the sovereignty and territorial integrity of China. That's a real statement from Marriott last year after an employee expressed support for human rights in Tibet. Marriott ended up firing that employee. The NBA has not been willing to go that far in the face of Chinese demands. While Morey took down his tweet, Commissioner Adam Silver said the league supports his right to free speech. That's contrary to the Chinese line, which is that free speech does not extend to support for what it considers to be separatist movements. But the NBA has also alienated Americans by expressing regret that Morey's support for freedom in Hong Kong had, quote, "deeply offended many of our friends and fans in China," unquote. And for a league that's prided itself on letting players express themselves on matters of social concern, neither players nor coaches nor managers seem to want to talk about the merits of the Hong Kong issue at all this week. The NBA's limp response has led to a bipartisan group of lawmakers from Ted Cruz to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez demanding the NBA withdraw from China until China agrees to stop selectively punishing the Houston Rockets for Maury's exercise of free speech on American soil. Lynette, as we can see with this example with Marriott and many others before the NBA, this has been going on for years. But this NBA story seems to have a lot of Americans focusing for the first time on the way China treats American multinationals and what that means for American values and free speech around the world. And worrying that instead of exporting freedom to China, as maybe we hoped to do 2 decades ago, that we're importing China's authoritarianism. Is that something we should be worried about?
Yeah, I think that we are no longer under the illusion that exporting Big Mac and basketball to China are going to get the Chinese Communist Party to change its values. And if you are not exporting values to China, you need to worry that China is exporting values to you. And that's the case here. Hong Kong has become a new third rail in Chinese politics. When the NBA went into China in the 90s, it was not that. It was, you know, they knew that, Tibet was off limits, Taiwan was off limits, Tiananmen Square was off limits, the three T's. Now Hong Kong has become part of that. This is a relatively new development. And I can understand that things are changing quickly. The kids in Hong Kong who are protesting are getting exactly what they want, which is becoming a flashpoint between the West and China. And it's a new reality that we're going to have to deal with, as well as the reality that Xi Jinping is far more bellicose, sees enemies everywhere and is far more aggressive than his predecessors.
So American companies look at this and they see China really caring about this stuff. And it's not always clear the extent to which that's the Chinese government caring versus the Chinese public caring. I think people do make an error the way they talk about this as though it were solely the Chinese government. I think some of this is genuine public opinion and consumer concern in China. But basically, these U.S. firms see this stuff is really cared about in China. U.S. consumers don't really care about this stuff. And so we should change what's in our movies so that it meets with, you know, with Chinese expectations about Chinese patriotism. And, you know, we should refrain from commenting on political issues that are flashpoints in China. And Rich, I just look at that. I'm not sure what to do about it. I mean, you see people saying things like, well, trading with China isn't worth it. But A, that, you know, that would be a big thing to try to change. And also, I don't even know what that would mean. Do you want to, are we going to prohibit people in China from watching American basketball? I think it's very hard to extricate yourself from the wishes of a large rising country with a lot of middle-income people that has, you know, about 1.5 billion residents.
Well, it is a real problem. And it just, China has managed this where they're in a dictatorial one-party state with a semi-market system that's created a huge and lucrative customer base for American businesses. And as capitalist enterprises, they're really responsive to that in ways that cause self-abasement. And the NBA is just the worst example of it. And just the astonishing hypocrisy of the NBA, you know, bullying North Carolina into changing a bathroom law it doesn't like, and then rendering itself completely mute on you know, heinous human rights abuses that are much worse than anything North Carolina could do on bathrooms. And by the way, China's horrible on gay and transgender issues, and no one will say a peep about it. It's just really despicable conduct. And and just having, by the way, confiscating a sign at an exhibition game at the arena down in Washington that just says Google Uyghurs. You can't hold a sign that says learn more about a minority group. It's completely insane.
I think, though, I will say the Chinese government in its tabloids seems to be backtracking. At first, 4 days ago, it was, you know, screw the NBA, we're very angry. And now they're like, okay, you can go back to watching basketball again. It's weird seeing the CCP do this because, for years, the Chinese motto was kind of bide your time, be polite, and, you know, don't show China's strength until it's fully strong. And now, you know, the CCP kind of unleashed the Chinese, you know, nationalism on the NBA and then realized, wait a second, we have to get this genie back in the bottle because the Americans are mad. I mean, I don't think China's ever pissed off Americans like this.
Is that why? Or it's not because I've been wondering about whether this is successfully splitting the Chinese consumer base from the Chinese government, which is to say that, like American consumers, you know, Chinese consumers might, you know, have opinions about Hong Kong. That doesn't necessarily mean they care deeply. And a lot of them do care deeply about the NBA.
But the question is, are we out of bide your time? Are we strong enough to show our strength? Or are we still in bide your time mode?
Well, but also,
and that's
like,
kind of that's the tension that China has right now, partly because of the trade war, partly because of Hong Kong. Are we strong enough to show our strength yet? Or are we still in this period of bide your time? And when Americans get really, really angry, China kind of takes a second and takes a beat and says, wait a second, maybe we're still in bide your time mode.
You don't think that they're concerned about losing internal public support where people are just going to say, I just want to watch the Houston Rockets, who I'm a fan of?
Yeah, I mean, that's one issue. And the other issue is, you know, what the United States has done to Chinese tech companies. They realize after what happened with Huawei, you know, if the Americans get really, really mad and cut off, you know, the U.S. semiconductor industry, they can still cripple our major multinationals. They can still cripple our advancement. They can still stunt China 2025. So are you in bide your time, or are you strong enough to make bellicose statements like this? It's a real tension right now, and I think that's why we're seeing this putting the genie back in the bottle in Chinese media, Chinese tabloids.
I wonder if there are ways to use the international trade agreement mechanisms to our advantage here, which is to say, we talk a lot when we have trade disputes with China about what we want out of them, that we want market access, we want U.S. financial firms to be able to sell products there, that we want them to respect the intellectual property of our software firms, of our pharmaceutical firms. What about respecting the intellectual property of our entertainment and sports firms? If we said to them, you know, well, we want market access for these firms, that means allowing companies in on an even playing field without discriminating against them on the basis of legal statements their employees might make in other countries. Now, obviously, I can imagine the Chinese would both resist rules like that and maybe not comply with them at all times, but that's a thing we encounter on pharma and software, too. It feels like this is a thing that we actually could negotiate for, and that, among other things, when China does these sorts of things, punishes companies for saying the wrong things, those are trade restrictions. It feels clinical to describe them as trade restrictions, but they are.
They are.
And we have ways of addressing trade restrictions.
I think that's an interesting point, and it would be a worthy goal. I would just worry, as a practical matter, it may require the Chinese changing their system even more than our current demands on them on trade. So it'd be very unlikely to result in anything.
I don't know. There's a reason why U.S. corporates were mixed on having this trade war in the first place, and it's because they'd gotten along, you know, kind of quietly doing what the Chinese said without Americans really finding out about it. And the trade war is bringing a lot of this to light, how much Chinese or U.S. corporates have kowtowed to the Chinese. It's embarrassing for them, and part of it is – part of why they kept quiet was because of this shame, because of the shame of getting their intellectual property stolen, changing the bad guy out in a Hollywood film. All of this has been very shameful. And unfortunately, now that the aggression between the U.S. and China has been blown out in the open, so too has the shameful behavior of U.S. corporates.
I think it's really weird the way the president has handled this story, which is, why isn't he eagerly jumping on it? Here, it's like this political gift to him. Here is this event that has created organic sentiment against communist China, and specifically against the way communist China does commerce, at the time that he's waging this trade war. And he has Ted Cruz and AOC and Tom Malinowski and people all over the political spectrum in Congress complaining about the Chinese. Why can't he pick this up and say, see, this is why we need to get tough on China. This is why we need the tariffs to squeeze concessions out of them so that they treat American firms fairly? It seems like this would be an opportunity for him to actually win over people who have been skeptical of his China policy. And he barely wants to touch it.
One, he hasn't been big on talking about human rights in Hong Kong himself. Two, he's afraid of offending China because he really wants at least some sort of papered over Chinese trade deal.
I mean, it's, you know, when we talk about the trade deal, we talk about what Trump wants and what people are expecting now. What Wall Street is expecting is nothing more than a pump and dump, really. Something like, you know, Trump doing some minor deal, saying a bunch of positive things, the stock market going up, and then during the next deadline, you know, things kind of falling off and going off the rails again. I mean, Trump can do no better than that. And in his career in the stock market, he never did any better than a pump and dump either.
But so then why are the markets up so much this week? Because when the president goes out and makes these statements about, you know, oh, things are, you know, the tone has completely changed with China. Things are so much better. I'm really excited about this meeting for this vice premier. I think the way this is covered in the news is basically as Trump BSing, trying to move the markets up.
He is BSing.
But then why don't the markets see through that? Why are the markets moving up? That you know, that should mean that they think that, you know, the economic outlook is better because this actually reflects a change in the way that our trade relationship with China is going to move.
Part of it is a pause, and part of it is a lack of conviction, I think, in the stock market. You know, earnings have been anemic. The thing that has really been holding up the stock market is shareholder buybacks. And this is some good news to trade on. And so people are doing it. And it is a there's a real lack of conviction in this market with the stock market. It's easy to scare people, and it's easy to get them excited.
And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My tweet is from the conservative writer Ala Pundit, responding to the news that the NBA was canceling media access to its players in China. And Ala Pundit says, "It'd be unfair to ask the players to answer difficult questions like, are concentration camps bad?"
Lynette Lopez, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My tweet is from Ryan Mack. He's a reporter at BuzzFeed, and he's been covering the Elon Musk versus the Hero Diver controversy. He tweeted, "We found the private investigator that Elon Musk hired to dig up dirt on a British cave rescuer was an ex-felon and scammer who defrauded past business partners out of more than $500,000. The guy cold emailed Musk, who hired him for $52,000 with little diligence." So this guy, who is a scammer, scammed Elon Musk. That's the tweet. Wow.
My Tweet of the Week is from President Donald Trump. He explains why we shouldn't worry about ISIS detainees getting out amid the chaos he's set off in Syria by withdrawing U.S. support for Kurdish forces. "In case the Kurds or Turkey lose control, the United States has already taken the two ISIS militants tied to beheadings in Syria, known as the Beatles, out of that country and into a secure location controlled by the U.S. They are the worst of the worst." Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois replied, "Ah, the other 10,000, no biggie. At least you got the big two. Campaign promise fail." I'd also note that these guys were called the Beatles because of British accents.
And there were only two of them.
Right.
There should be two more.
But they were the Beatles, like the band, and yet the president spelled it Beatles, like the insects.
No, he didn't.
I've been talking with Rich Lowry of National Review and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider. When we come back, we will talk with Stephen Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations about the president's shock decision in Syria and what it means for our security and the world's. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Lynette Lopez, columnist at Business Insider. President Trump seems to have shocked even his own cabinet departments by announcing on Sunday he would withdraw American military support for Kurdish forces who control much of northern Syria. This announcement has essentially cleared the way for a Turkish invasion of parts of Syria. Turkey's long had a hostile relationship with the Kurds, which has been awkward, as both Turkey and the Kurdish forces are allied to the United States. Trump's action drew outrage from Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill, who said the move constituted a betrayal of Kurds who stood with us against Saddam Hussein and fought on the ground to defeat ISIS. They said it would hurt America's ability to make credible commitments to allies in the future, it would subject the Kurds to violence at Turkish hands, and it would risk the release of dangerous ISIS militants held by those Kurdish forces. To discuss all of that, we're joined by Stephen Cook. Stephen is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Hello, Stephen.
Hey.
First of all, what should we expect on the ground in Syria now that we've withdrawn the support?
Well, the Turkish Armed Forces is conducting airstrikes and artillery strikes. Ground forces will soon follow. Most of those ground forces, at least the leading element of those ground forces, will be what we used to call the Free Syrian Army. This is the remnants of the Syrian army, militant groups, and others who have signed up to fight the Assad regime, but really found their only international supporter to be Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. They have done much of the fighting in other Turkish incursions in northern Syria. They don't have a great record. in terms of human rights violations and abusing the local population. On the Kurdish side, there's no way that the Kurdish People's Protection Units, known commonly by its acronym YPG, can face the mighty Turkish military. So what they'll do is embark on a guerrilla campaign in the hopes of keeping the Turks in the area and bleeding them over a long period of time.
And so what does this mean for all these ISIS prisoners? Are they just going to get out in the chaos surrounding that? And what does that mean for security?
Well, that is the fear of what will happen. The concern is that those members of the YPG, which is part of a broader group called the Syrian Democratic Forces, that have been guarding upwards of 90,000 ISIS prisoners and their families, will be drawn away from these makeshift prisons and fight the Turkish military and their allies. That'll make it easier for ISIS fighters to escape from these areas. We know, despite the president's declarations that the caliphate has been defeated, that its leadership remains intact, that its cadres want to regroup, that it is already undertaking operations both in Iraq and Syria. So the fear is, of course, that this is providing an opportunity for the Islamic State to once again threaten allies in the region as well as in Europe and perhaps even the United States.
So, Rich, this is an action. The president has flirted with this idea in the past. He's talked a lot about the idea that he wants completely out of Syria. But he has been walked back from this historically, in part because of strong opposition, not just from Democrats, but also Republicans in Washington. It appears that is not working anymore. Is there what justification, if any, is there for the president's choice here? And Republicans on Capitol Hill are very upset about it. What are they going to do about it?
I think there's very little justification. And it's the very definition of an unforced error. There's no reason to do this. It's true the Turks don't like having the Kurds on their border. It's true that our Kurdish allies may not be the greatest people. They're allied with the PKK, which is undertaking terrorist attacks in Turkey. But there's no reason to do this now. It's not going to end, quote unquote, endless wars. We're just moving our very limited military presence back from the border to allow the Turks to do this. The best argument you can make perhaps is, look, the Turks are NATO allies, so their feelings about this should be taken really seriously. But this isn't going to enhance our relationship with the Turks. It's probably going to make it worse because you have major congressional action to try to severely sanction and crimp their economy. And it's kind of a weird case where actually Trump has sort of backed off. They backed off after the act that made this unavoidable. Now he says it's a bad idea and the Turks should stop and they shouldn't do it. But they got the green light by the pullback and the call with Erdogan.
I think I might be more right than Rich on this issue, so sorry about this. But the Turks betrayed us by purchasing Russian weapons and they shouldn't be in NATO anymore. Secondly, we're sending troops to Saudi Arabia after this attack on an Iranian oil tanker. So much for the president actually caring about not putting us in endless war and not putting troops in harm's way. Forget about that. And lastly, because the president is so corrupt, we need to scrutinize every single decision that he makes. We don't actually know if he made this decision because he is a dove. We don't know why he made this decision with Erdogan. We know that, you know, Rudy Giuliani has been traipsing all over Turkey. So we need to really actually think about why this is happening. It's we can't take the president on his word.
There are a few aspects of that to delve into. Stephen, I want to ask first about the nature of our alliance with Turkey. Turkey is our NATO ally, but our relationship with Turkey has been strained, to say the least, in the last decade plus. What is the value of that alliance to each side?
The best way to put it really is that Turkey is a treaty ally of the United States, but it's hardly a partner of the United States. And it's once been hard-pressed over the course of at least the last 5 or 6 years to account for things that Turkey has helped the United States with. They helped Iran evade sanctions. They have clearly complicated our mission in Syria, which is to defeat and degrade the Islamic State. They have purchased a Russian air defense system that was designed specifically to shoot down NATO aircraft. There's been a whole host of other issues that the Turks have done because they want to pursue a more independent foreign policy of the United States and the West. President Erdogan sees himself as a leader of the Muslim world, and that from time to time draws him in conflict with the Western consensus on a variety of things. So it's very, very hard. I think people in Washington are holding on to this relationship because of the Cold War and the romance that goes with Turks fighting and dying with the United States during the Korean War. But at this point, there's not much to that relationship other than saying Turkey is a NATO ally and it's an important country. Of course, it's an important country, but that doesn't mean that we share interests or, quite frankly, values with the Turks.
Rich, Turkey keeps showing up in weird ways in various scandals in the Trump administration, going all the way back to former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, who was being paid by the Turks to seek the extradition of this cleric, Fethullah Gulen, from the United States to Turkey, where he'd be essentially a political prisoner. We had this story this week about the Turkish efforts subverting Iranian sanctions. This criminal defendant in the United States, Reza Zarab, who was a client of Rudy Giuliani's. Giuliani actually got the president to go to the Secretary of State and say, can we find a way to release this guy? What can we trade him with the Turks for? The president, of course, has his own financial interests in Turkey with Trump Towers, Istanbul. Do you worry about this seemingly inexplicable policy decision that he's made? I realize that the president has a generalized desire to get U.S. troops out of the Middle East, although, as Lynette notes, he's just sent more troops to Saudi Arabia. Do you worry about the role that all of these strange financial links may be playing in the president's choice here?
I tend to think this is just poor judgment. You know, maybe I'm naive. Maybe there's some connection to his hotel or future brooded about business deals in Turkey. But I just think this is something that is in accord with his natural reflex, which is to liquidate our commitments in the Middle East. And if circumstances force him to, or political allies force him to, he'll check it. He'll even send a few forces back, but he really ran and had a consistent record for decades saying that this was really bad for us. And I think he's wrong about that. I think Obama's wrong about that. I think precipitous pullouts mean you're going to have to engage in, you know, so-called strategic reentry, the way he did with Iraq after the rise of ISIS. But this unfortunately accords with his natural instincts.
So, Stephen, where does this leave us? Walk us through what might happen in the region in the coming months and years. I mean, what happens, for example, if some of these ISIS fighters get out? Or what happens with increased Russian or Iranian influence in Syria? To Rich's point, are we going to be forced by one thing or another to reengage there?
Well, it's certainly the case that we're going to see ISIS come back. I think everybody who's looked at this over a period of time recognize that the president has declared the defeat of the Islamic State, but the attacks continue. And with this precipitous action of pulling back and drawing the Kurds away from guarding ISIS fighters, I think it's inevitable that we're going to see more and more violence on the part of ISIS. I think the broader question, though, is that the subject of Saudi Arabia has come up twice now, that a few weeks ago there was a major attack on two oil processing facilities in Saudi Arabia, and the Trump administration's response was extraordinarily limited. That had sent a message to the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Egyptians, the Israelis, and others in the region that the United States' commitments, not necessarily to their specific security, but to broader American commitments about the free flow of energy resources in the region, had been compromised, and that America's word wasn't good. Along comes this precipitous change in the relationship with the Syrian Democratic Forces or the YPG, and it's just another example that the United States, from the perspective of regional allies, that the United States is leaving. It's leaving in an irresponsible fashion. And they, therefore, must take matters into their own hands. And that's what worries me. When American allies start taking their matters into their own hands in the region, they hedge with the Chinese, they hedge with the Russians, they start invading neighbors to pursue their interests. And what you have is more chaos. You have a United States that's weaker than it was before. If we want to get back to a negotiation with the Iranians over Iran's nuclear program, not responding to Iranian provocations, not precipitously leaving Syria is the way to go. We have a weaker hand as a result.
Stephen Cook is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Great pleasure.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, what's on your mind?
It's worth noting at the same time Democrats are freaked out by the supposed constitutional crisis represented by Ukraine, they are boosting the candidacy of Elizabeth Warren, who on guns, taxes, and energy policy, among other matters, is promising unilateral or lawless governance, which would be of widespread concern if all of us really did value constitutional and legal norms.
Lynette Lopez, what's your rant?
My rant is about Elon Musk, who has put auto summon into some of his Teslas. This auto summon, which is supposed to bring your car to you in a parking lot, is hitting other cars, hitting garages, like hitting random things in the streets. And it has to stop. Where is the National Highway Transportation Safety Association? Where are the regulators? Somebody is going to get hurt.
For my rant, Beto O'Rourke, who is running a dead-end presidential campaign, has been enjoying himself by saying all the things that Republicans keep saying Democrats would like to say that other more serious Democratic candidates have been refraining from saying, such as that he wants to take away your guns and he wants to confiscate AR-15s that are out there, saying he wants to take away the tax-exempt status of colleges and universities that don't have progressive views on LGBT rights and other things like that. Max Rose is a congressman from Staten Island who won a district that Donald Trump had won. Staten Island is Trump country within New York City. And he points out in a recent interview in my magazine, New York Magazine, with David Friedlander, that Beto O'Rourke has gotten so much attention for losing a Senate race. Why doesn't anybody pay attention to Kyrsten Sinema, who won a Senate race in Arizona, a state that Democrats had not won a Senate race in decades? Max Rose says, quote, "I don't think losing is cool. I want the Democratic Party to be the party of Kyrsten Sinema and not the party of Beto O'Rourke. Losing is not as cool as he thinks it is," unquote. I think that is good fodder for Democratic voters who maybe still have at least a bit of residual idea that Beto O'Rourke is cool. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Lynette Lopez, and Stephen Cook. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and P.J. Shahamat are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.